Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Isabel Fry is joining us this morning. We wanted to talk about poverty and inequality. Can it pose a threat to stability? And of course, it's a conversation that's very evocative at the moment, because when we, what I have found is anybody that tries to have this conversation is immediately, I'm trying to mix up the word, hammered and slammed for doing so. A conversation around this is no way a justification for criminality. All it is a discussion around, does it lead, or can it be one of the components that lead to, that can lead to instability? Isabel, a very good morning to you. With that disclaimer, And I'm sure you've had to defend this conversation over and over the last few days.
Good morning, Howard. Morning to your listeners. Thank you. That was perfect. I couldn't have scripted it better myself. Absolutely. The research that I do looks into the levels of poverty, and from that we can see the impact on mental health. But I do want to start with that, which is that this is such a complex issue, and we're talking about things that many people are not comfortable talking about. And so the reaction, whatever your race or class, is to try and shut down a view that challenges one's own. I think it's just, it's natural. So, I've had some quite severe reactions, negative reactions. But what has been amazing has also been a growth in people wanting to talk this, wanting to understand, saying that they hadn't seen it, they hadn't thought about it. And so I think that conversations such as the one that you're hosting now with me are just so useful to give people a safe insight into alternative ways of thinking, because to polarize in a situation of crisis is the most dangerous thing that we could do. We need to be looking at solutions to move us to completely more stable positions, and we can start looking at structural changes.
So what cause, in what way does a poverty, inequality, perhaps disempowerment, cause this type of situation?
I think it's critical just to start answering that by sharing with your listeners just some key statistics, so that we know the landscape that we're talking about. Prior to COVID, we were seeing a situation where one in two people was living in South Africa under the poverty line. And one in four was living under the food poverty line. So in other words, people were already in a state of food insecurity and economic insecurity. What we've seen since COVID was quite interesting. Initially, it was because the grants were being paid, we saw a slight reduction. But since those have stopped, we've seen a situation, the data was released last week, where we see 3 million children are in absolute starvation, 13 million people in total. And that's on the back of the fact that we have 23 million unemployed adults. So people in South Africa, the majority of people, face daily insecurity in terms of economic well-being, in terms of building a future, let alone feeding themselves today. So there is that huge state of vulnerability and disempowerment. And I think it was useful that you used that word, because that comes to what I'm going to comment on now. One of the main findings of the COVID NIDS CRAN data was the rise in mental health problems arising from the levels of poverty. So with physical starvation and hunger, with hopelessness for the future, comes a huge sense of mental instability. And it doesn't take a leap of analysis to realize that if people's mental well-being is being challenged, it's not possible to expect there to be rational, reasonable actions and reactions, particularly in a hostile situation where society just doesn't seem to be structured to support you. And rule of law is something which is a foreign concept rather than security and comfort that many of us in the middle class see it as being.
To some extent, is it a surprise that this has taken so long to happen?
Yes, in short. The analysis over the last 10 years has shown the increasing levels of poverty and the increasing levels of inequality. And I think I, forgot to mention that that's also an important ingredient. Where you see inequality, people are able to see that it doesn't have to be this way for them because it's not this way for their neighbor. So the fact that South Africa is one of them, is the most unequal country in the world, certainly is spark what we're seeing right now. But I think we should also just remind ourselves that violent outbreaks in this country are not new. We know, for instance, that domestic violence is a crucial, it's so crucial that our president referred to that as the second pandemic, at the beginning of lockdown. We also know that at times of stress, we are witness to incredibly savage attacks on people and community and property. So I think that possibly the coming together and more concerted effort is something that we need to recognize as being a kind of potential tipping point, but it's not new. And I think how it would be really good if we could just look at some solutions that could take us through this.
I think it's in fact absolutely vital, because otherwise what we do is we look at it and say, well, it's hopeless because we've got this. There's nothing I can do around employment and the situation. There is poverty around. So is this just going to be something that we have to learn to live with? Well, do we? Are there solutions?
It's important for us just to realize at this point in time that what we're seeing is not going to persist. It is not structured in any way. So this is going to fade, and that gives us an opportunity to start looking at structural transformation. One of the interventions that our research has shown time and time again in the countries where it's employed has brought incredible stability is the universal basic income grant. It's a cash payment to everybody. Those who have sufficient income, it's taken back through the tax system. The reason why it is such an important policy intervention is, firstly, as a universal payment, it means that everybody is included. We don't marginalize and say, you're poor, you're not poor. We're all included, and many have called it a democratic dividend. When it was first mooted in 2002, the idea being that we receive this as citizens, as residents of South Africa. The other really necessary part of it is that it's a certain payment. Each month, you know that something's going to come through. It's also, because it's universal, you don't penalize people who try to look for work. And that's the problem with the current grant situation, is because it's means tested. If you earn 10 rand above the means test, which is incredibly low, the means test, it means that you forfeit the stable income. So if you're in
right, so it's an incentive. It's an incentive not to find a job.
Precisely. Whereas a basic income grant can act as a springboard. It can give you some certainty so that you can start taking those incremental risks that enable you to get involved in some kind of enterprise, to support your neighbor's enterprise, to start looking a childcare so that you can go and look for a job. It is a fundamental restructuring of the risk and the burden that prevents so many people from trying to move forward in a situation, an economy which historically has been built on excluding people rather than including. And we've engaged quite significantly many times with National Treasury. And the data is there. We've given the costings to Treasury. And our concern is that the process of policy formation takes a very long time. What we're seeing now is a crisis, and we really believe that a commitment to embracing a basic income grant will give the political message that the plight of people who are vulnerable is recognized and prioritized. And it also gives us the mechanisms in order to start the process formulation. And of course we would also advocate for the fact that the longer term basic income grant be preceded by the reintroduction of social relief of distress. We think that that was sadly missing from the speech on Sunday night. Although the recognition was given to workers who are finding the situation tough. And we think that was an omission which should be remedied as soon as possible.
Although that said, you know, given what I said in my introduction, I think he might have come under even more pressure if he referred to that, because it might have been perceived as it being an excuse or a justification for criminality. And I think that he might have... And not that I think he did particularly well in general with his speech, but yeah, I think he might have been even more severely criticized had he done that at that time. I think that speech was about calming, maintaining, you know, and getting things under control. There's more opportunity, and there's plenty of opportunity and requirement for him to now look at it and say, well, look at the situation in South Africa. Look at our unemployment. Look at the number of people who are starving. And I think that's also the other aspect. I know that a good percentage of the I call it looting porn that I'm sent, which I've chosen not to watch, a lot of it often centers around people walking out with a 53-inch TV. But from what I understand from people on the ground, there's a lot of foodstuff being taken, because it is also about that. And it's easy for us to roll our eyes at the guy trying to shove a TV into the back seat of a car, implying that he has his own transport and he's not exactly hungry. But there are many, many people who are.
Absolutely. I think that social media has democratized information to a very large and positive extent. But it also means that there is a kind of a prevalence amongst those who wish to shake the jar to use that channel. The analogy that comes to mind is the child support grant that goes to 17 million, actually 13 million poor children right now. People argue against it, saying that they know that some young women use it to do their hair. Now, I mean, you have to take a step back and say, are you seriously going to say that this is not going to benefit the millions of people who do use it? Mm. Likewise with the looting. I mean, I think the picture of someone going out with a bag of mealie meal creates such less controversy than someone going out with a TV. So I heed the call that has been made time and time again, and I'm sure your viewers will as well, that we need to be discerning about the media that goes out.
Absolutely.
And in a way, to circulate fake news is as much a violation, as one could argue, as the looting itself, because it goes to the heart of our fears. And that can only lead to quick snap decisions, most of them reactionary, and ones that don't help to contain and to deflate the situation. So,
right.
I mean, from our side, what we're going to be doing, we have a meeting this evening at NEDLAC as part of the community constituency. We'll be placing unequivocally our demand for the basic income grant. And we believe that it's something that we believe that organized labor will be supporting us in this. And as you said, it's having set the hard parameters, we're really hopeful that at this point in time, the sort of soft underbelly of the chaos and the tragedies will be something which we can now start addressing.
And I'm going to say something further, is that I do believe that we are smart enough to recognize that many things can be true at the same time. And we can look at the complexities of the situation. We can demand a restoration of law and order whilst looking at some of these other aspects. I think to limit ourselves is to not give ourselves enough credit for who we are and what we are capable of. It is 8:51. That's where we're going to leave it. Isabel Fry, Director at a Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute, talking to us. I'd love